session. If you're planning to be a part of the session, please come in and take your seat. And we'd encourage you to move in so that we have a critical mass in one place. This session is called One Room, Two Classes, Gender Difference in Sunday School Discussions. The presenter is Karen D. Austin, whom I have just met, but who I'm looking forward to getting to know better. The topic is one that interests me very much because I teach in a single-sex independent school. All my students are girls, and because we compete with coeducational schools in our area, we're always hearing a lot of the literature, a lot of the arguments that girls are better off if they're educated without boys around. And it turns out that there's a lot of really fascinating research on this subject that will be important to you if you are parents, if you have children who are going to have educational needs that you need to be addressing. And it's also important to us as teachers in church to look at how our teaching is perceived by men and by women and how men and women might react differently in the same setting. So we turn the time over to our presenter for what I'm sure will be an interesting discussion.
I'm high advantage, so I'm going to swing the mic over here so I don't get eclipsed by the podium. And then there's no barrier either, so it's also ideologically important. I try to put on the end of each row the handout for my presentation. It has the key works I'm going to be drawing on and some key quotations so that when I read large blocks of text from the researchers, it's easier to concentrate because you have these also. It's like, wow, what did she say? And then you can take this home. Also, for those of you who are interested in looking at the entire paper, Michael and I both have put our Sunstone papers on our webpage, and so there's the address for mine. Without further ado, I will just begin. Oh, and my apologies to those of you who might be in Salt Lake, because I gave a version of that paper here, and it's exactly the same. Okay, 9-month-old baby, nursing, full-time job. I'm just happy to be here. One Room, Two Classes, Gender Differences in Sunday School Discussions. While attending Gospel Doctrine over the last several years, I have noticed that the same few class members make the majority of the comments. At first, I thought perhaps these talkative students were merely outgoing, or better educated, than the quieter members of the class. But then I noticed that the same shy women, who rarely spoke during Gospel Doctrine, walked down the hall for the next hour of worship and transformed into avid participants in their women-only classroom. It was then that I decided to focus my informal observations on the role gender plays in the amount and kind of comments made in Gospel Doctrine classes. I've developed an even greater interest in this topic since being called in June to teach Gospel Doctrine in my ward in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. I imagine that my interest in this topic not only stems from my current calling, but also from the graduate work I have pursued in composition and rhetoric. Many of my classes in teaching methods and philosophies of language center on questions of gender. How does gender affect perception? How do men and women use language differently? How do men and women differ in the content and style of their comments? The underlying question often boils down to this. How do men and women, and indeed do men and women, differ in their intellectual, psychological, and moral development? My graduate studies were aimed in part at helping me run a writing classroom and would encourage that would both encourage men and women to improve their writing and participate fully in class discussions. So naturally, I'm curious to see how this same dynamic plays out in a Sunday school classroom. Even though Sunday school classes reject or at least may temper many academic traditions such as skepticism and the reliance on quantifiable data only, I believe that some of the questions and research about gender differences in the academic classroom can be applied without much tweaking to the church classroom. A couple of years ago, I tried to present to others in my Santa Barbara ward my questions about gender and some of the research I had found on the topic of how gender affects classroom dynamics. I experienced only limited success. When I was called in 1997 to attend the teacher development course in Santa Barbara, I expected part of our training would include a discussion on how to involve students who have various learning styles. I expected the training materials to include contemporary education theory on the differences among visual learners, verbal learners, and so forth, and maybe even one class dedicated to questions of gender differences in learning style. However, I found that the printed curriculum did not discuss gender differences at all. I brought this up with the leaders of the teacher development class, but when one of the leaders and I later tried to bring up gender as a dimension of teacher preparedness during the class, two of the most outspoken members of the class, who both happened to be men, were adamant that gender played no role in determining who made what kind of comments in class, or what amount of comments in class. Furthermore, they said to suggest as much was foolish political correctness, because other members of the class found this conflict contentious. Any further discussion on the topic was completely shut down. This cold reception, however, persuaded me to read more on the topic and to question classroom discussion that leaves many women quiet during mixed-gender classes. For a time, I thought I might pursue this topic by creating a data set so I could formalize my analysis. I could supervise the audio taping of several gospel doctrine classes in my ward and several others so that I might gather data on the number of comments made by men and women and on the nature of their comments. In rummaging around in a few books, I found that several sociolinguists have already done this labor-intensive work, and I'm going to assume some parallels between a college classroom and an adult Sunday school classroom, at least until I decide to invest in a box of cassettes and a transcriber. Because I do believe in the value of observable data, let me start by summarizing the findings of a sociolinguistic on the subject of gender differences. This summary was written by Mary Belenke and her co-authors as taken from their book, Women's Ways of Knowing. This quote appears on your handout as quote number one. The burgeoning field of sociolinguistics focuses on male and female patterns of discourse, sex-linked language, and sex differences in conversational patterns. Women talk in both style, hesitant, qualified, question-posing, and content, concern for the everyday, the practical, and the interpersonal, is typically devalued by men and women alike. Women talk less in mixed groups and are interrupted more often. End quote. I would also like to add that other research shows that that women's comments in mixed gender groups are also generally shorter than men's comments. Even though I still find the idea of taping a compelling project, I decided instead on a more manageable project. In this paper, I will investigate a few key texts on the topic, texts from the fields of psychology, sociolinguistics, philosophy, and composition, and apply their questions and findings to a gospel doctrine setting. I could also ask how these two settings, academic classrooms and church classrooms, may differ and how these differences might influence the ways men and women talk to each other in public or formal church settings. But that's another paper topic. The first work I would like to introduce and apply to a Sunday school setting is one that many of you may have already read, since it was for a time a number one national bestseller. Sociolinguist Bert Hannon has written You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation, which is a pop linguist book that presents her observations on the differences between two dialects, or genderlects, as she calls them. She claims that because men and women grow up segregated into same-sex play groups, they develop different conversational styles. Tannen suggests that if adults learn their way of speaking as children growing up in separate social worlds of peers, then conversation between women and men is cross-cultural communication. And she brings that term up, cross-cultural, in part because the book she wrote right before that was about cross-cultural communication, people from different nationalities and racial and ethnic identities, and then did the one on gender. In order to bridge the gap between these two cultures, male and female, Tannen suggests that men and women become bi-dialectal, or capable of adopting, or at least understanding, the other gender's conversational rules. Early in her book, Deborah Tannen provides an anecdote from her marriage as an illustration of the types of misunderstanding men and women experience based on the different conversational styles. Following this anecdote, she then presents these conclusions, which also serve as a summary of her primary findings. This appears as quote 2 on your handout. Tannen says, having done the research that led to this book, I now see that my husband was simply engaging the world in a way that many men do. As an individual in a hierarchical social order in which he was either one up or one down, in this world, conversations are negotiations in which people try to achieve and maintain the upper hand if they can and protect themselves from others' attempts to put them down and push them around. Life, then, is a contest, a struggle, to preserve independence and to avoid failure. Tenen continues about the women. I, on the other hand, was approaching the world as many women do, as an individual in a network of connections. In this world, conversations are negotiations for closeness in which people try to seek and give confirmation and support and to reach consensus. They try to protect themselves from others' attempt to push them away. Life, then, is a community. I struggle to preserve intimacy and avoid isolation. Though there are hierarchies in this world, too, there are hierarchies more of friendship than of power and accomplishment. End quote. Ten observations on the different roles conversation plays for men and women may explain why some women talk more in Relief Society than they do in Sunday school. These women may feel as though the class discussion in Relief Society focuses more on building connections and sharing personal experiences than on displaying expertise over scriptures and doctrine. In early June, I watched women stay out of a conversation in my own gospel doctrine class when a participant made a doctrinally incorrect statement of the Melchizedek priesthood and temple worship during the reign of Solomon. In response to that, members of the class quickly thumbed through their Bible dictionaries in order to correct the false statement. During the conversation that marked the rise and resolution of this conflict, the women were quiet, including the teacher. Tannen's theories of conversation would predict that female class members may feel personally attacked when they are challenged on points of doctrine, which may lead women to choose being quiet rather than risk a possible challenge. And as a side note, I didn't put in here, I have a friend who's pursuing a degree in physics, and in her senior seminar classes, the teacher would really grill her on some of her ideas, and then she'd like leave class and cry and all this stuff. And she talked to one of the male class members about this, and he's like picking on me and putting me down, and he's like, no, he respects you. He's like, he's doing that because he likes you. And she really like think about that and reconceptualize why she was getting that kind of attention. The discussion I led on the Book of Ruth illustrated Tannen's findings in another way. Women did comment during that lesson, but one shared experiences about her mother-in-law, and another woman talked about using a verse from this book on her wedding announcement. The men's comments focused on establishing who knew the most about Levirate laws that determine who was Ruth's nearest kinsman and determine how she was finally married to Boaz. In addition to the summary that Tannen herself provides in the opening chapters of her book, I've reproduced a table that I penned in the front cover of my copy of her book, compiled during my reading. She tends to like describe things in really heavy polarization, so I have a table that reflects those two poles. If you look at table one in your handout, you will find a list of traits Tannen attributes to the conversational styles of men, which contrasts with the traits she attributes to the conversational styles of women. One of Tannen's points is that these styles contrast, so she usually presents these traits in pairs. And you can look at these, like independence versus connection, knowledge versus empathy, hierarchy versus equality, etc. For example, she argues that men's conversation work to display knowledge they possess, even if this means shifting the conversation to an area of their expertise. She adds that women's conversation works to display empathy, even if they have to exaggerate an experience in order to establish common ground. If you look at these two columns, you can get a quick overview of Tannen's findings about gender and conversational style. Teachers may find this valuable when planning the content of their lessons and the types of questions they will ask and types of discussion they will foster. For example, I try to structure my lessons so that I have a balance between conveying knowledge on points of doctrine and asking questions about how we can apply this knowledge to our contemporary lives. I've noticed that the men tend to dominate the discussion about ancient Israel's politics, history, religion, and some points about the Hebrew language, while the women tend to dominate the discussion on how they see parallels to their everyday lives, or to apply this to, oh, my brother, or my neighbor, or my sister. While we are looking at this list of contracting styles, I want to stand back for a minute to add a few qualifications. Okay, this is my big hedge. Okay. Even though I am making comments about the way men and women speak, I must concede that these categories are based on generalizations, which may or may not hold true for every specific man or specific woman. I have seen many examples of men who speak with empathy, who seek community, and who show support, like Albert. Likewise, I've also seen many women who speak to establish expertise, who challenge others' authority, and who approach problems with solutions rather than a heavy dose of empathy. Just try to watch me and Michael at a dinner party and see who's elbowing him for more table time. Likewise, I have also nevertheless, I think Cannon's categories of male and female and the traits she attributes to these groups are useful, okay, as metaphors and categories. Okay, they're going to be contradicted and defiled, but they're useful for language, just for gross generalization, for discussion, and can even start really healthy debates about how stupid these labels are. Okay. Even though the act of dividing people into two polarizes into polarized categories is flawed, I think Tannen's and other researchers' observations on gender can contribute positively to discussions about who talks when and about what for how long. In other words, I also hope that by applying these observations to a mixed-gender class, some quieter men may feel more comfortable making contributions during gospel doctrine. The second work I would like to apply to a Sunday school setting is Carol Gilligan's book, In a Different Voice, Psychological Theory and Women's Development. Gilligan's book starts with an explanation that many giants in the field of psychology evaluate women as inferior in their moral development when placed in models constructing men as the norm. Many of these models value independence and abstract thinking, which leaves many women measuring up short. Gilligan points out how Freud, Erikson, and Piaget all conclude that women are flawed morally when compared to men. She then focuses much of her research on challenging the conclusions made by psychologist Lawrence Kohlberg, who, not so coincidentally, was her mentor during her graduate studies. Some of her first publications are co-authored with Kohlberg's name first. Kohlberg's model of moral development was grounded in the rationale that his subjects made in response to hypothetical situations designed to place the rights of life in conflict with the rights of property. Again, the aim of Kohlberg's research was to evaluate the rationale for moral decisions, not the decision itself. So it didn't matter so much what they concluded for action, but their path of reasoning that led them to that conclusion. Kohlberg's theories, like Freud's, Erikson's, and Piaget's, value independence as the primary task of adulthood and abstract principle-based thinking as the most advanced means for making moral decisions. Gilligan suggests that women possess an alternate, not an inferior, system of morals, one that values connectedness and relationships. However, Kohlberg places many women in his research in an inferior position on his scale. What Gilligan suggests initially is an adoption of two separate but equal models for moral development. Still later in her work, she will suggest a blending of the two models. Not only does Gilligan conduct her own research by interviewing several women faced with a different moral dilemma, she also reviews some of the transcripts from Kohlberg's research in order to illustrate the different ways these subjects rationalize their decisions. In one section in her book, Gilligan reviews the different approaches a male child and a female child, both 11 years old, make on the moral issue. These two are asked to respond to Kohlberg's dilemma involving impoverished Heinz, his dying wife, and the refusing druggist. Gilligan then draws these conclusions about the children's methods for moral reasoning. This is quote 3 on your handout. Gilligan's analysis. Just as Jake is confident the judge would agree that stealing is the right thing for Heinz to do, so Amy is confident that if Heinz and the druggist had just talked it out long enough, they could reach something besides stealing, and he considers the law to have mistakes. So she sees this drama as a mistake, believing that the world should just share things more and then people wouldn't have to steal. Both children thus recognize the need for agreement, but see it as mediated in different ways. He impersonally through a system of logic and law, she personally through communication in relationship. Just as he relies on the conventions of logic to deduce the solution, so she relies on the process of communication, assuming connection and believing that her voice will be heard. Yet while his assumptions about agreement are confirmed by the convergence in logic between his answers and the question posed, her assumptions are belied by the failure of communication, the interviewer's inability to understand her response. Because the interviewers already had constructed this model, and when Amy and other women in this study tried to give a response that was not described by the model, they like didn't know where to record it in their rubric, okay? And they kept trying to ask them questions to lead them to the model. And as a side note, I took the GRE, I took a bunch of practice tests and then took the GRE, and you know how they have that section, like if Sam is sitting next to Joe and someone's wearing a yellow hat, who killed the butler? I always got so distracted. Well, why did someone know wear that stupid hat? And who murdered this poor guy? And, you know, Michael and I watch, Law and Order, and I'm always like, after the TV turns off, well, what's going to happen with this person? And it's so sad, da, 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 and how are they going to resolve this conflict? And he's like, no, that was like a logical puzzle about the law, and the narrative was just this like drapery so we could like meditate about logical conundrums about the law. Those people aren't going to exist. We turned off the TV, it's over. But I'm so worried about it. So, and there are people who experience that. Okay. Gilligan's research implies that women's comments might focus more on exploring the nature of relationships when determining what action to take. This might explain why many women, when discussing gospel principles, whether in Relief Society or in gospel doctrine classes, respond by explaining specific family problems and their rationale for how to address these specific problems. Contrary, the members of the gospel doctrine classes I've attended tend to focus more on the specifics of the standard works or the fine points of doctrine more than offering personal struggles as an illustration of the lesson's themes. I do concede that both Relief Society and gospel doctrine participants talk doctrine and apply these principles to their lives, but the ratio tends to tip one way or the other depending on the gender of the class members. I've never attended a priesthood meeting, so I would have to rely on others to report on the ratio of doctrine to personal application to see if Gilligan's theories hold true in that all-male setting. Yeah, on another side, I had a class at BYU in the philosophy department about how to study the scriptures from kind of like a hermeneutical tradition coming out of Judaic Old Testament studies, Tanakh studies. And the teacher, in trying to give us all these really technical tools for studying language, and logic and such, told a story of how he taught gospel doctrine. This one woman, when they're trying to do this, I asked Miss Steph and Isaiah, kept raising her hand and talking about some conflict with her daughter and how annoying that was. And it was totally off tangent and why she could stick with the lesson. And I'm thinking, well, you know, if we can't apply this to our lives, why bother? So, okay, interesting enough, Gilligan herself provides examples from the Old Testament that illustrate the difference between man's willingness to sacrifice people to truth. Okay, so that abstract thinking's higher, like Goldberg would say. That and Gilligan explains that Abraham prepared to sacrifice the life of his son in order to demonstrate the integrity and supremacy of his faith. Abraham stands in implicit contrast to the woman who comes before Solomon and verifies her motherhood by relinquishing truth in order to save the life of her child. Okay. I don't quite agree with the way Gilligan sets up these two examples, because I believe the difference lies not in the particulars of the narrative, but in the interpretation of these stories. I've been involved in discussions of Abraham's sacrifice that frame his decision as placing his relationship with his son below his relationship with God. And I've also discussed the story of Solomon and the dispute with the child as being from a case of submitting to the authority of the king over the common sense conclusion that the half-child would not live. Okay, nevertheless, I accept her interpretations of these two biblical accounts as coming from one of many possible gendered perspectives. To illustrate how the same subject matter can evoke different responses depending on the participant's gender, let me compare two occasions when one lesson from the New Relief Society and Priesthood Manual evoked different responses. At the beginning of the year, we started the manual with an overview of Brigham Young's life. The Relief Society teacher made no mention of the fact that the manual completely leaves out any mention of polygamy. when one class member asked about this absence and the fact of, the rest of the sisters expressed anxiety about her bringing this up, and that this wasn't me, by the way. But I interpret this anxiety as people wanting to stay with the authority of the manual and wanting to avoid conflict in the class. In contrast, the elders' quorum teacher, which was reported to me, interjected this fact about Brigham Young's polygamy at the very beginning of his lesson, and the men talked at some length about the way members and non-members see polygamy history of the early LDS church. So the conflict was the point in priesthood. More recently, I have observed the same lesson, eternal progression in Relief Society and Priesthood Manuals being taught in two different ways. Well, actually, one was reported to me. The discussion in our awards Relief Society focused on developing relationships as a dimension of eternal progression, especially family relationships. The Elders' Quorum teacher shared his notes and participants' comments, which he explained reflected the discussion that included the taking personal responsibility for individual choices. So eternal progression, then, was maximizing one's individuality for the priesthood discussion. These examples from my wards, all women and all men classes, seem to follow Tannen's and Gilligan's theories about gender, speaking styles, and moral development. Okay, the third work I would like to apply to a Sunday school setting is the multiple authored book, Women's Ways of Knowing, The Development of Self, Voice, and the Mind. Authors Belenke, Clenchey, Goldberg, and Terul adopt a similar goal as Carol Gilligan's. Instead of seeking to expand on Goldberg's model, Belenke and her co-authors find that William Perry's model of intellectual development excludes women, primarily because female subjects were screened out of his subject groups. William Perry's model, I actually used this a little bit in Temperate. I have this great book with a great chart and diagrams and all this stuff, pull out chart in the back. Talks about how freshmen started off, I believe the study was done at Harvard, started off with dualistic thinking, I'm right, you're a pig. And then started to notice that there were other points of view, started to question their own point of view, and then kind of fell into this like morose, catcher in the rye, everybody's a phony, kind of like modernist angst thing, where a lot of black smoke clothes cigarettes, you know. And falling into despair because of pluralism, and then coming out of that by junior, senior year to committed relativism and saying, hey, you know, there are different points of view, but let's roll up a short sleeve, commit to one, and keep going until we feel as though we need to change this. But the women, Linky and others found, weren't fitting into Perry's model. And Perry's model just really set up how a lot of textbooks and curriculum were established. In order to create a place for women in higher education, Belenke and her co-authors interview a number of women in traditional and non-traditional classrooms. They discover that most of these women explain their intellectual development through the metaphor of voice. Okay. The women explain how they move from silence in the presence of authority to mimicking that authority. My daddy says, or you know, Sigmund Freud says. Then using a newly discovered voice to challenge that authority to finally establishing their own voice. I say. Okay. The women Belenke and her co-authors interview describe how they establish their sense of self-mind and voice to a large degree from their roles in family systems and from their belief that anyone in a position of authority, including school teachers, textbook authors, curriculum planners, cannot be questioned because these authorities possess the truth. Women in the early stages of development do not recognize that a lot of knowledge springs forth from the speaker's value, self-interest, background, and experience. So school teachers, textbook authors, and curriculum planners have bias, which goes unrecognized. Many of these women choose silence because they doubt their own experience, or they do not believe that they can convince others to accept their point of view, even if they do know the difference. In the worst case scenarios, many of the women who were interviewed by Belenke and her co-authors could not recognize an inner voice, point of view, or self that differed from what the most outspoken member of their household believed and what their teachers taught them. One woman experienced a conflict between, when women experience a conflict between their lived experience and the knowledge that others tried to pass off to them, the women reach a state of crisis that calls for a change in the way they see the origins of knowledge. For example, I attended a relief study lesson a few years ago when the teacher, a lifelong member of the LDS Church, spoke harshly about Catholics, describing them as living spiritually incomplete lives. Many members of the Southern California class were converts from Catholicism who valued what they learned about Christian behavior and still maintained close ties with their extended family, who are all still practicing Catholics. Because the women in the class experienced a truth that contradicted the teacher's statement, many of them chose to challenge the teacher's authority in order to integrate their lives as LDS members with their past as Catholics and their present relationship with Catholic family members. And there was a little bit of conflict, but smoothed over, and, oh, I still love you, sister. Okay, according to Belenke, Clinchy, Goldberg, and Terul's research, women who choose to be quiet in gospel doctrine may not have the self-confidence to challenge the teacher's interpretation of the standard works, even if that individual woman has a different point of view to offer. I have observed women de-emphasize their own opinion when they do offer an alternative interpretation. They often hedge by prefacing it with comments like, well, I may not be correct, or, well, this is only my opinion. These have invite the teacher and other class members to dismiss these women's comments too readily. Belenke and her co-authors describe the final stage of self-voice and mind by drawing on comments made by three of their subjects, Kay, Erica, and Adele. Please refer to your handout for quote number four to see what these three women subjects said. Belenke and her co-authors conclude that To learn to speak in a unique and authentic voice, women must jump outside the frames and systems authorities provide and create, so that they may create their own frames. Kay, Erica, and Adele told us that their current way of knowing and viewing the world, a way of knowing we call constructed knowledge, rather than received knowledge, began as an effort to reclaim the self by attempting to integrate knowledge that they felt intuitively was personally important with knowledge that they had learned from others. They told of weaving together the strands of rational and emotive thought and of integrating objective and subjective knowledge. Rather than extricating the self in the acquisition of knowledge, these women used themselves in rising to a new way of thinking. As Adele described it, you let the inside out and the outside in. In applying these ideas to Sunday school setting, Belinky and her co-authors invite members of gospel doctrine classes to find ways to integrate their inner lives with their participation in a community such as an LDS church. This is an activity that I can identify with on many levels. Like the women in their study, I find that I must jump outside the frames and systems the authorities provide and create my own frame. As a graduate student in rhetoric and composition, I had a number of fellow students ask me, how can you become a member of an academic community while still participating in your religious community? Over and over and over again, I got that question. I find that I must find a way to weave together the strands of both of these communities by talking about my academic work in church settings and talking about my religious experiences in academic settings. I appreciate the occasion of this conference for allowing me to work towards an integration of my inner voice and my public voice. I wonder how many women sit in Sunday school thinking interesting thoughts, but wondering how to bring these ideas into public forums so that a forum that has so many strong voices of authority, written or spoken voices, already present in that Sunday school classroom. A final work I would like to briefly apply to a Sunday school setting is Nell Nodding's Caring, A Feminine Approach to Ethics and Moral Education. Gilligan contrasts a male ethic of responsibility with a female ethic of caring. However, she does not provide an elaborate theoretical model for this ethic of care. Instead, she illustrates it by sharing segments from extensive interviews she and her co-researchers conducted. For a more thorough description of the ethic of care, I suggest looking at Nell Nodding's book. I'm going to kind of give her short shrift compared to the others. As a philosopher, Nodding seeks to describe the ethic of care by drawing connections to and making distinctions between this ethic and long-standing philosophical traditions that assume ethical systems based on men's lived experiences. The most powerful lived experience that Nodding sees as shaping women's ethical system is the experience of motherhood. This relationship serves as a primary model for her moral system. Nodding also makes suggestions on how to transform the classroom in order to promote an ethic of care. Basically, she calls for teachers and students to de-emphasize the task of transmitting information or cultivating an aesthetic in favor of emphasizing a relationship of care between the teacher and student. Nodding says, in pointing maintenance and enhancement of caring as the primary aim of education, I am drawing attention to priorities. I certainly do not intend to abandon intellectual and aesthetic aims. However, we cannot separate means and ends in education because the desired result is part of the process, and the process carries with it a notion of persons undergoing it somehow to be better. In other words, Nodding insists that the classroom be a place where we enact our ethical ideals, instead of seeing the classroom as an artificial environment for receiving knowledge about ethics and morality, and then we leave the room and then enact it beyond the room. With this in mind, I hope that we can examine the ways we talk to each other in gospel doctrine, the way we foster participation, and the ways we invite people to contribute so that we can enact our visions of the Christian community at the same time as we discuss the gospel and the doctrines of this community. Thank you. I'll try to remember to repeat the question, given what was said earlier about buying tapes. I think that was Clay. Well, does anybody have questions or comments or anecdotes? Or yes. Okay. Questions about what I do myself in my gospel doctrine class to try to balanced comments by men and women who attend my course. Yeah, I found that I initially wrote this paper when I wasn't a gospel doctrine teacher. It was so easy to, like, flesh out the perfect teacher. But and after I get done, I try to kind of analyze what I did. And for a time, I was even taping them for this paper, and then I thought, oh, I'm totally biased. I'm taping myself on this. But what I try to do, I kind of use some of the terms that Paulo Freire uses. He talks about the banking model of education, which he's trying to replace with the dialogic model of education. The banking model is like give people lots of knowledge, okay? You like open up their head and put in the money. And the dialogic is you engage them and you set the curriculum right then and there. And I try to balance between banking and dialogue, between like giving lots of facts. You know, like I read Harper's Bible Dictionary and I get the Jerusalem Bible, I read all the footnotes and I get on the web and read all these Bible sites. And I try to like bank the first 20 minutes or so. And then ask some kind of technical questions and do maps and charts and history of the kingdoms. And I get participation there by people who are really interested in the history and politics. And then I switch over to like, okay, what principles are here? And then sometimes like kind of principle debate things. And then I do what's lacking among ourselves. In fact, my big pet peeve is that a lot of people in application will say, oh, those horrible, evil Jews. Okay? And I'm like, nope, no one can say that in this class. Okay? We have to draw 20th century parallels, and it's not, oh, my horrible, evil neighbors either. Okay? Not that I want people to, like, confess their sins right there in my class, but, so I try to make up really goofy examples about, I do what John Donne does in his sermons. And I do all the self-confessional stuff, like I talk about, oh, my evils of speeding, or saying something mean to Michael, or, you know, some dishonest thing I did at work, or some proudful thing I did. And I tend to see that at the beginning of the course, when I'm doing all the banking and kind of the technical stuff, the men tend to talk more and get out their scriptures and scripture chase. And at the end, the women are, oh, my brother did this, or, you know, I try to do this in my home, or I've, you know, always felt this way. But there are exceptions to the rule, but I tend to see that. And in fact, when I go home, sometimes if I feel like we've done all this, like, touchy-feely stuff the whole time, I'm like, oh, man, I got to do some research. Or if we do all this, like, Solomon's Temple with how many cubits, then the next week I'm like, man, I got to do more application and more, like, principles to apply today. So I'm always trying to maintain a balance between different styles. And I also try to, like I refer to, like visual and oral learners, like when we were doing Elisha, I like made a little cake and oil and all this stuff, and I try to bring in visual aids. And I've had a couple people say, oh, I'm a real visual learner, I'm glad you do that. So, you know, not that I'm the best teacher, but it's just what I do for a living, so I'm really self-conscious about it. So any other comment? Yeah. Come see this in the mic. Nadine Hansen took me on his whole life, so I'm ready for you.
Good, Kara. It's not that I disagree with the fact that men and women have different conversational styles, but what I find interesting is why we always report the women's one as having some higher value, as being better, you know. And I think you did a very good job of trying to not do that too much today. But I think any woman who's, if anybody has ever had a baby and sat around at a primary meeting or a board meeting at church and talked about your experience having a baby, it's a war. It's hierarchy to the max. You know, it's, I didn't have to have pain drugs, did you? Or, oh, really? You don't breastfeed? Well, you know. I mean, women are excellent at establishing hierarchy and in a very subtle way, knifing everybody in the back. And when you come out of those group discussions, there's winners and losers. I mean, women go home crying because they knew that they were put down. So, you know, I find it very odd to, and especially as a feminist, to assume that somehow women are all about caring and empathy. I'm like, you know, number one, I don't think so. And number two, sometimes we have different methods of trying to make our case or establishing, you know, our sense of power in the situation. But what makes that better? Why is it better to use less logic? Why is it better to establish connections rather than asserting some facts? And, you know, I sort of feel like maybe it's time as feminists that instead of fighting so hard to establish some kind of territory for our own way of communicating and then pressing the world, please accept this is the way we communicate and it's better, why don't we just co-opt some of these male ways of communicating and win?
I think that's a really good comment, and I've seen in discussions, you know, either ones that take place in a book or a course or among core group of friends, often takes up like kind of Hegelian dialectic that starts off with, you know, patriarchy's good, and then it's like, no, it's flawed. Matriarchy is the way to go. Yes, sister. And then you do the dialectic blending of the two. And I heard Jim Faulkner give a paper at BYU. He got an award a year. I can't remember the name of it, but his paper was on looking at philosophical positions that take these metaphors of male and female. And then at the end, he did the predictable and very appealing marriage of the two. And I think that resonates in a lot of people. There's some kind of, you could say, some heterosexism in that. To try to frame all community discourse based on a heterosexual model for union. But I think a lot of people would agree that that's the way to go. But I've seen a shape in discourse that says, this isn't working, this is a good alternative, how can we blend them? And I even pointed out that Carol Gilligan's book starts off with saying separate but equal, but by the time she finishes her last chapter, she's like, oh man, let's not do separate but equal, let's blend them. Yeah, and in the comment about the competitiveness, I saw a sitcom called Holding the Baby that's new about going to a playgroup, and she was like, oh, it's about community and help, and we like nurture each other. And then after we see this playgroup, it's like, oh, Johnny can roll over, and Sarah's talking, and my baby does nothing. Or I just got back from L.A., and a friend of mine and I were talking about how women can be so competitive, and they can even be competitive as to, like, they'll do, my husband's so wonderful, blah, 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 blah. And then if the other woman's like, no, my husband's the wonderful, then they'll be, oh, my husband's so mean and horrible and a slob and bad with money, blah, blah, blah. No, my husband's more mean and horrible and bad with money. So, yeah, I don't know, maybe it's the empathy game, you know, like you need to give me more empathy and I need to win the empathy prize. I don't know. But I do acknowledge there's competition among women. Well, I'd have to talk about gospel doctrine and Relief Society being different because I don't attend priesthood. But I'm sorry, am I getting the nature of your comment? Okay, this student, I teach college, this participant is asking for more anecdotes for how women feel this tension when they're in mixed gender discussions versus when they're in same gender discussions. Yeah, I mean, I just noticed, as I said in the beginning, that women who say nothing in gospel doctrine, you cannot shut them up in Relief Society. Maybe part of this was when I was really doing a lot of observation on this, I was in a student ward in Santa Barbara, and it happened to be true that most of the people who were in graduate school were men, and not all were married, but the wives often didn't have degrees, and if they did, it was only bachelor's, and they quit and worked. And we had two Sunday school classes. We had like Gospel Essentials, which was supposed to be for new members, and Gospel Doctrine for people more experienced. It turned into like Gospel Doctrine Heavy and Gospel Doctrine Light. And the single people went to Gospel Essentials, and they did all this like fun stuff, like bring in videotapes of Dr. Laura and, you know, and really schmoozy hip happening stuff. And then in Gospel Doctrine, it was the graduate student men primarily just hashing things out and playing top dog and just like crazy. And my friend Chris and I, who were the only two women who were in graduate school, would try to jump in there and be part of this big dog pile discussion or try to draw some of the women out, you know, and say, oh, Jeanette, I know you know interesting things about that. And Jeanette's like, you know, then you go into Relief Society and these women who would not say a word while sitting next to their husbands in the gospel doctrine class who are like, I'm trying to do this deal with my daughter, I'm having this conflict with my mother-in-law, or I really noticed this about faith, and I didn't have faith about being able to do a Christmas program, and I prayed, but they never tell stories like that in gospel doctrine. So I'm asking, what about the environment? And the thing that's the most noticeable is mixed gender there, single gender, in Relief Society. So I don't know, does anybody else have an anecdote? I mean, are you basically asking, is this really true? Does this happen? So does anybody else have an anecdote that where they observe this might be true? Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's not the sister missionary, return missionary? Yeah, no, clearly I think because people inhabit subject positions besides gender, this is like way more complex than I've led on to being.